you notice, it's freezing in here. You might want to put on a jacket. You can feel the ice trickling down your neck. You can feel the Arctic breeze moving through. Just keep those thoughts in mind. We'll make it through a whole class. It's actually not too bad right now, relieved to say. Okay, so first, Carl, where are you? Carl?
My name is Carl Rogers. I've been in this class for a while, and I've been teaching classes on the biology of aging for a little over a year now here at CLL. Tomorrow morning here at Johnson in room 3, I have a class that means 3 Saturdays in a row on aging in the brain, and it's basically the third time I've taught it, so we get the benefit of some past experience and latest news and some of the developments and the problems of aging in the brain. So I invite you to join the class tomorrow if you're so inclined and you have space in your schedule. And there's flyers over there. You can see the reminder.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. This is, again, Carl Blasius, and if you're interested in what's going on the forefront of biology, especially having to do with dealing with the aging process and hopefully retarding or reversing it, then Carl's the man. And it's a remarkably clear but authoritative class.
Let's put down the alphabet. I think the
I'm going to talk about that later. Okay.
What?
I'll talk about it later.
Okay.
Mary, do you want to announce?
Sure. Hi, I'm Mary Lawson. I've been in this class for 3 years. And since this is a class on happiness, I thought I'd tell Spencer about my friend Ruth. She's a colleague and a dear friend. And she is singing songs, creating songs that are all about changing the way you feel about yourself and increasing your level of happiness. And so Spencer very kindly for allowing Ruth to come up for just a few minutes to talk very short and then do one of her songs. And I hope you all enjoy it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mary Ruth. So Ruth, why don't you use the mic to talk?
Yes.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Ruth Wisher-Grenet, and I use music and movement to help increase focus and confidence and happiness in people of all ages, a child and all of us. And I've been doing this with kids from as young as 6 months old to people all the way up until their 90s, people with Parkinson's, people with autism, people neurotypical, so it's just a whole range, and it's been really incredible. And my CDs and DVDs are in 14 countries and 27 states and provinces at this point, and I have a sign up over there, and I can talk with you a little bit more after class if you'd like. So I'm going to sing a song, and it's called Confidence. And I'd like to invite any of you who would like to stand up and join us to anchor it and get some happiness into your body.
So if you want to stand up, it would involve everyone. Just a little motion.
Yeah, there are three basic movements.
You have
three basic movements. One of them is to go like this. You're crossing in front of you, your pulse and cross. Pretty easy, right? The next movement is confidence curls. So curl in that confidence. Okay, a beat of 4. And then the last one is curling it on the side. 1, 2, 3, 4. And then you point to your head and you push that confidence out to the world. Psh. Okay. My toes, confidence is who I am. Mary, thank you, Spencer. Really appreciate it. I'd love to offer you that free song if you'd like to sign up over there on the table after, at the end of class. And I also have some CDs and DVDs with me if you'd like to purchase one of those. So thank you again for having me, and I look forward to being in class.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ruth. Again, if you would like that song, email to you at the end of the class, and I'll remind you at the very end of class, just put your name on the list, and Ruth will email the song to you. Also, if you are more interested in the whole CD, see Ruth at the end of class. She has some with her that you can purchase. Thank you so much. That's a great way to start off class. Confidence is who I am. That's what I need to hear. That's where we're going today with the class. All right, so first of all, I think I'll use the mic some of the time anyway today. We're going to sit now, but I need to talk to you a little bit again about mindfulness. By the way, you can do anything you want during this sitting. You don't have to be mindful. This is just what I'm suggesting. So what I'm going to do week after week is just talk a little bit about what we're doing, a different aspect of it, and then lead you a little bit, but week after week, I'll lead you less and less and lead you on your own more and more. Okay. So, Petalie.
There's an inkling.
Say it.
There's an inkling. And the fan is on.
All right.
Thank you.
I guess if I use the microphone, you can hear me even with the fan. In regard to mindfulness, there are two things that seem to be opposite that we're doing. And depending on the day, and depending on your level of experience, one or the other might be more appealing to you. Ideally, they come together in a sitting, but not always. So the first of these things, the more available aspect of mindfulness, is the aspect of letting go, releasing tension, of becoming calmer. And that's the thing that we can teach most easily to kids and the general public. The idea is just, if you come back to your breathing over and over with your attention, every time your attention gets lost in thought or wanders to an emotion or pays attention to a sensation, if you bring your attention back to your breathing and just rest your attention on your breathing, you calm down. And if as you do that, you soften and open yourself, your face, your body, your mind, your heart. You just let everything soften and open. Well, what happens is you'll get calm, settled, and you'll feel expansive, spacious. You won't be fighting anything, you won't be tense. So that's the first aspect. And for many people, when they do that, they fall asleep. The great insomnia cure. But that's... And beginners have a tendency to kind of lose consciousness when they get more relaxed, because our habit is the more relaxed we are, the less conscious we are, that's when we go to sleep. But there's another aspect to mindfulness which has to do with becoming more aware of thoughts, feelings, and sensations. If you pay attention to your breathing and you soften and open, then after a while what happens is your awareness clarifies. And you're able to hear or see your own thoughts, if they're verbal or visual or both. You're able to feel your feelings much more powerfully than when you generally are walking around and lost in thought. You tend to feel your sensations more clearly. Your hearing is better. Your smell is better. Your eyes are open. Your sight is better. You can feel things going on in the body much more acutely. So, and at the same time, as you're aware of these things more completely, you're less compelled by them. You're less determined by them. You are witnessing the you thought you were and the world that you were formerly absorbed in. So the witnessing perspective is a more subtle and difficult to realize aspect of mindfulness. What you're looking for is, and I'm going to use this suggestion, you've heard me do it before. Once you get everything softened and opened a little bit, and you get to pay attention to your breathing, then I'm going to say, open your attention around your breathing. So that there's no border or boundary to your attention. So that your awareness goes out in all directions without it living. It's as though there's breathing and just this field of knowing, of perception, of possibility that goes out in all directions. And in that field, there's chatter in your head sometimes. There are feelings moving through here. It doesn't feel like it's here anymore. It feels like the front of you. There are sensations coming in. So it's as though you're the wide open sky in which all sorts of weather events are happening. Look, clouds of thought blow by and a lightning storm of pain, lightning pain flashes through, and some rain or some sunshine of emotion drifts through, and a little bird whips through, which is a little intuition really quick, So you're just breathing, opening your awareness, and allowing whatever is happening to happen. You just notice it very clearly, but you don't get lost in it. If you get lost in it, you remember to go back to your breathing, soften and open, and allow everything to be just as it is. You're not trying to change anything, block anything, fight anything. You're just opening to everything, but taking one step back so that you're witnessing rather than you are involved with what you experience. So of course, this brings up the question of, if you aren't these things, who are you? We'll talk about that as time goes on. What is this awareness if it isn't thought, feeling, or sensation? He didn't talk to us about that. All right, so here we go.
Spencer.
Yeah.
Are you aware of your breathing and your speaking?
When I am sitting and speaking or right now?
No.
Well, now that you said it, otherwise. Typically, when I walk around, I'm not walking around being mindful. Sometimes I am, sometimes I'm not.
Isn't that the goal?
No. It used to be, for me, the goal. Now the goal is to move easily between the two kinds of consciousness. When this one is working fine, generally, I kind of like to experience selfness when self is healthy. But the minute that self doesn't feel right, I want to go here. And some of the time, I just want to be here because there's something beyond self. You're welcome. Okay, so that's it. First of all, if your shoes are pinching your feet, loosen them or take them off. Or if you're an experienced meditator, what are you doing with your shoes off? You're going to meditate. Secondly, if there's anything preventing you from breathing, like and your belt is too tight, see if you loosen it so that you can actually breathe. Third, how to sit. John Kabat-Zinn says you sit with dignity. Thich Nhat Hanh says sit like a mountain. Not rigid, but erect. Both feet on the floor is generally best so that you feel stable and balanced. If you like, you can have your eyes open looking down. Most of us are going to want our eyes closed because it helps the relaxation and opening process. But as time goes on and you practice by yourself, practice sometimes with your eyes open as well as closed, because you want to be able to be mindful in all situations when you need it, not just when you're sitting with your eyes closed. But for now, let's say your eyes are going to be closed. So close your eyes or look down. And simply feel that you are breathing. Just notice how it feels to breathe, what parts of the body are involved. Don't try to change the breathing, just notice it as it is. That the front of your body, especially your lower abdomen, rises and falls with your breathing. That is, your belly moves most of all. Let that happen. Let your belly be soft so that it can move naturally. You may also notice, although it's harder to do so, that your chest is rising and falling just slightly with your breathing.
The belly is moving more in a more pronounced fashion, but the chest is also participating. So up and down, open and close, rise and fall. You're just resting your attention on your breathing. You're not trying to do anything. You're just noticing the breathing happening. Now, if we were extremely, extremely sensitive, we could notice, and perhaps you can, that the entire body participates in the breathing. With the in-breath, everything opens and rises slightly. That is, not only do the chest and belly move, but also the head and neck come up just a tiny bit. The shoulders, arms, and hands turn out just a tiny bit. Even the legs and feet open with the in-breath, just the slightest amount. Even the back rises with the in-breath. And with the out-breath, everything closes, falls, just the slightest amount. So there's plenty to pay attention to with your breathing. There's a whole body involvement. And your basic job is just to rest your attention on this gentle, soothing motion. I'm going to very briefly bring us through a progressive relaxation of the body. Let's start with the face. Let the face soften and open. If you're holding an expression on your face, let it dissolve. Let your face smooth out. Your eyes are not held closed tightly, but gently, softly closed. Your mouth and jaw are soft. If there's any tension, let that tension release itself. So your mouth and your jaw and your lower face can become very soft and gentle. Sides of your head, back of your head, top of your head, similarly, soften and open. Any tension in those areas is let go of, just releases itself. And your face and your head are soft and open. It's almost like they're not there. It's almost like where a solid head used to be, now there's just empty, open space. And you can feel the gentle breathing, the rising and falling of the front of your body, especially. Anything else that you notice is perfectly okay. Just let everything be as it is. Whatever you notice is part of your meditation. Pay special attention now to your neck and shoulders, arms and hands. Let your neck and shoulders, arms and hands soften and open. If there's any tension being held in the muscles of your neck, shoulders, arms, or hands, let that tension release itself. So that it feels almost as though your neck and shoulders, arms and hands are disappearing. They're becoming so soft and open. It's almost as though they aren't even there. And there's just spaciousness where there used to be solidity. Return attention now to your breathing if you've been paying attention only to your neck and shoulders, arms and hands. Come back to the breathing. Feel the gentle motion of your lower abdomen and your chest, and in fact your whole body as you breathe. Just rest your attention on your breathing. Don't try to change anything. Just let everything be as it is. Your only job is to notice what is occurring. Pay special attention now to your torso. Back, sides of your body, front of your body. Let the back, sides, and front of your body release any tension that is being held, so that the back, sides, and front of your body are softening and opening. Even your internal organs are softening and opening. Any tension is released, your internal organs function harmoniously, easily, smoothly. It's almost as though your torso is disappearing, and where there was formerly a solid torso, now there's open, empty space. You can feel your breathing just happening naturally. The rising and falling of your lower body, of your belly, your lower abdomen, your chest, and in fact the whole body participates subtly in the breathing. Pay special attention now to your lower body, lower back, pelvis, legs, and feet. Let your lower back and pelvis, legs, and feet soften and open. If you're holding any tension in your lower body, let it release itself, so that your lower body becomes ever more soft. Open. It's almost as though your lower body is disappearing, and where it was formerly solid, now it is spacious and open. It's as though your lower body is now empty space. Feel your gentle breathing happening easily. Natural. Open your awareness around your breathing so that your awareness goes out in all directions without limit, without boundary, without edge. Your awareness just stretches out infinitely in all directions. And in the center of this awareness is breathing. Just the feeling of your gentle breathing. Let your mind open completely now, so it is entirely spacious. Thoughts can come easily without resistance through your mind, and you can let them happen and notice them without getting absorbed by them. Your mind is open, empty. Let your body open completely now, so that your feelings and sensations can flow freely through you. You can notice them, you can let them be whatever way they are. You can let them come, and you can let them go. So your mind and your body are wide open. And you have the capacity to notice whatever is occurring without losing awareness of your breathing and without becoming absorbed in whatever you are noticing. You just breathe. Soften and open ever more completely, and notice whatever occurs. When you lose your breathing, just gently bring your attention back to your breathing. I will ring the chimes or the bell in 7 minutes. Any effort. Let go of trying to do anything. Just notice your breathing and whatever is happening. That's all you need to do, is just soften and open. Feel your breathing and notice whatever is taking place. So there are two benefits to what you just did. No matter what your experience was, you got at least a little bit of these two benefits. First benefit, at least to some extent, you let go of tension. The habitual tensions that we carry around in mind and body. So if nothing else, this was practice in releasing what may be unhealthy levels of tension that you walk around with. Probably everybody got that to some extent, even if you fell asleep and put the tension release. That turns out to be extraordinarily valuable. Almost all of the spectacular results of mindfulness practice that you read about have to do with the release of habitual tension. Your immune system works better even if you only release tension for a few minutes a day. It restores the function of your immune system, it lowers your blood pressure, it makes your heart rate more regular, etc., etc. The other benefit that you may or may not have realized, but you probably did to some extent, is that you became aware of suffering. Thoughts in your mind, emotions that you were having, preoccupations, issues, etc., etc. So you were looking at those things which formerly had fully absorbed you. So you gained some insight into how you function. As time goes on, you get more and more insight into how you function. That is, things which were formerly not conscious become conscious because you're becoming more conscious. So you're realizing unconscious aspects of yourself that are nonetheless present and important in determining how you function. So as time goes on, there's a deepening of your insight. And that happens session by session and over a long term. So you become more familiar with the patterns which rise into awareness, and you, over the long term, watch those patterns solve themselves or open or heal themselves. So each sitting is practiced in letting go and tuning in. And over the long run, you become more relaxed and healthy and much more self-aware and self-controlled. That's why I spend the time to teach you this, because it's the most direct, effective thing that I could teach you about even healing and growth. So now we need to change gears. All right, now I'm going to talk this way for a while because it's constraining to talk that way. So if you can't hear me, tell me. But I can belt it out like Ruth did for a little while anyway. Okay, Mind Supermind. It's probably sold out at this point. In this room on Monday night, it had 124 seats. I think 123 of them were sold last night, so it's probably sold out. So if you don't have tickets, don't tell them I said this. But I know they're going to set up a few more seats in here for walk-ins. So get here early on Monday if you don't have tickets, and get online, and maybe you'll get in. And I can't tell for sure what it's going to be, but my feeling is it probably is going to be pretty amazing. This guy is something. It's about being a seer. That is, being able to directly perceive another person's field and how it is functioning. And Peter makes he's a scientist, so he makes a hard-headed noise about this. So if you have one foot in either camp, he does too. He says, how do you reconcile the scientist in you and this other ability? And he spent a lifetime hopefully reconciling these, but certainly trying to. That's Monday, so it's exceptional, I think. Okay, with regard to... Most of you, I think, are reading the book and doing the suggested exercises. So let's talk just a little bit about making social connection or gratefulness, thankfulness, the exercises for the last 2 weeks.
So I just want, you know, there's a large group, so we can't have a huge discussion, but I'd like to hear a few people's voice each week chiming in about what they found from the exercise. So if you would like to talk about one, I
can give you the microphone and you hold it about an inch from your lips.
And you, Julie.
I'm grateful, is it brain last Sunday? We needed the rain because of the drought.
So one thing that many of us are probably grateful and thankful for was that it rained.
So yeah, but I want to hear more comments about those of you who did that exercise. You know, I said five things a night, new things wherever possible. Just take a moment to be grateful or thankful for these things. Tell me your first name.
I'm Carol.
Carol.
A few weeks ago, you told us the difference. I find they overlap, the three good things. Because something good happens, and then I'm grateful that it happened. And then, could you just repeat that, how they are different? You did that once before. And then the use of six, say why, what? Why, the first part, three good things. Could you explain the why again?
Okay, so, in fact, these exercises are very similar, they blend for most folks, but three good things was each night before you go to sleep, think of three good things that happened that day and why you think they happened. So we had a good class. Why? Because the group was so good. You know, so tonight when I go to bed, we had a good class this morning. Why? Because the people in the group were amazing. So three good things is three things that happened that day and why. Gratefulness, thankfulness is just list five things in your life that exist that you're grateful or thankful for. So it could be something that happened, it could also just be something that is. I'm grateful for my bedroom. I'm able to sleep, you know, it's nice to have a roof over my head and to go to bed. So before I went to sleep last night, I went, you know, I'm really grateful for the fact that I have this nice place to let go in. I'm grateful for the food that I eat. You know, there's so many things that we overlook that if you take a moment to be grateful for them, what happens is over time, your heart opens up and you realize how blessed you are. So some people do gratefulness, thankfulness, or a version of it for their whole life. Some people do three good things for their whole life. Some people blend these things. But I think these are, and they're very empirically supported. These are things that really do make some difference in how you feel. Because you really, what's becoming salient to you is the good. Otherwise, the default is the bad, as we've talked about and we'll talk about further. So you really have to balance the natural tendency to look for threat by the conscious tendency to look for those things which are life-supporting. Okay, a couple more people talking about gratefulness, thankfulness, or a social connection.
Doing the gratefulness exercise reminded me of another way of doing it that has embedded in it an expansive awareness and also the lessons of interdependence of our life.
Closer.
Okay. Starting to hear myself. And that is, and I wrote about this a lot years ago, reminded me of it, I've not thought of it in a long time. And that is to take an object, your broccoli, the road that you got on here, and you say, I'm thankful for the broccoli, and I'm thankful for the person who cooked it. I'm thankful for the store that sold it to me. I'm thankful for the farmer, the laborers that grew it. And it expands your awareness to how interconnected we are, how unified we are. And it's just a particular way of using that gratefulness exercise.
It's a beautiful exercise. Thich Nhat Hanh talks about intervening, you know, and talks about this exercise. Yeah, so the idea is you take something, I'll just repeat, it's such a beautiful exercise. You take something, anything, and you say, I'm grateful for this. How did this get to me? I'm grateful for the person that sold it to me. I'm grateful for the person that imported it. I'm grateful for the person that put the seed, that harvested it, that put the seed in the ground. I'm grateful for the rain that made the, you know, made me realize how interconnected everything is. So it's stunningly, I think it's a very good corollary to this exercise.
And if you find yourself saying, I did it on my own, excuse me, right, that BS.
Well, I did it on my own. Let's see, who taught me how to be me? You know what I mean? So, thank you. Very good. You might want to try this. It's really a enlightening exercise. Couple more people, Bill and then Michael, and then we're going to move on.
This has to do with meeting the people.
Yeah.
I do this where I could be in a line at the supermarket or CVS or whatever, and I'll talk to strangers. People behind me, in front of me, complete strangers, I'll just start a conversation. And I've noticed at first it didn't really work, and then it started to work too good. It really opens up. A lot of time to practice meditation, speaking to my heart. When I got back to that point, probably the floodgates open, and I had to sort of taper down. But that's what I do. I talk to complete strangers that I would never do, and I just talk about anything. And you see what
the response is. People really appreciate that. When people feel like they're not seen, they're not acknowledged, they're alone. So even if we were walking down the street, you just make eye contact and say hello. Two things happen. Usually the person feels bad that they didn't say hello to you. And so they make a mental note to say hello more next time, because this is Santa Barbara and you're really supposed to. But also, they just feel like somebody saw me. I wasn't the wallpaper. I exist. So I think it's a big, you just take it one step further and actually talk to these folks, which is lovely. But even just to make eye contact with people as you pass and give them a nod or say hello, it really changes their feeling at that moment, and sometimes pretty powerfully, because they can't feel entirely lost or alone or insignificant. But I think it's a beautiful practice, and really helps.
Since I said this morning, my garbage man were there, and I said, I really want to thank you for helping to keep all of us clean.
Yeah.
And he looked at me, his eyes went like this, and he said, well, thank you, honey.
You know, she's talking about thanking the garbage people. And, you know, I think we need to do that, because every time I drive by them, I think, man, that's a hard job, and they're doing so well. And if they weren't doing it, it'd be so bad. And I, you know, but I never say it to them. I never go, you know, I should just acknowledge that I'm appreciative, you know, when they're doing it. Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, maybe that guy say it. Absolutely. Okay, so there's one more person, Mark Michael.
Every day, many times a day, I practice something called segment intended. I learned this from watching the movie The Secret, and a woman named Esther Hicks outlined it. And what it's about is focusing attention and intention on the next segment that's going to happen in my day. And part of that, when a segment is finished, I spend a little time reflecting, and a big part of that reflection is gratitude. And just feeling the good, the positive things that happened and being grateful for. And it's a cycle that I try to repeat many, many times a day. And it's just really powerful. It just makes me shine.
So what Michael's talking about is living intentionally, as opposed to living kind of in haphazard fashion or living reactively. Those of you who are very briefly, you know about locus of control, any of you? Locus is location, L-O-C-U-S. There are two loci of control. Most of us have what's called an external locus of control. That is, we feel life. We deal with what comes at us. The control is outside us. We just simply react. And we wake up in the morning, we think, oh my God, what are we going to do today? What's life going to throw at me? And when we go to bed at night, we think, thank God I didn't screw up too bad. You know, that's external locus of control. That's the way most people live.
internal locus of control turns out in a lot of research to be a lot healthier. People with an internal locus of control wake up in the morning and they say, what have I created in my life today? And as they move through their life, they realize that they're creating, their choices are creating the outcomes that happen. So they feel in control of their lives and that they intentionally put together the experience that they have. So that's called, what she's doing is internal locus of control. And it makes you feel a lot better, a lot more effective. You are a lot more effective that way. For next week, okay, I'm really going to encourage you to do this when I can't, you know, I don't have a grade to hang over your head, but the exercise for next week is called Disputing Negative Beliefs, and it's at the end of chapter six, I think, the one that we're reading for next week. I would suggest reading that chapter fairly soon, or at least skipping to the Disputing Negative Beliefs part at the end, and starting that process. It's basic cognitive therapy, it'll be very familiar to many of you, but do it his way. Do the A, B, C, D, E process formally, 5 times. You don't have to write it in your book, but practice it formally, because in difficult situations, it makes you more able to use this disputation that is so valuable. So we're going to talk about this at some length next week. So your challenge for the week is do the A, B, C, D, E disputation process at least 5 times the way that he describes how to do it. Okay? Then we'll talk about it. Len.
Is this disputing beliefs, false beliefs in yourself or in your friend?
It's in yourself. In yourself. No, you don't want to do that. Do this in yourself, not in other people. Okay. otherwise, you're going to have a lot of problems. Here you go.
Can I just add one comment to going back to saying hello?
Yeah.
When I was first coming to this country, brand new, I was down in about 24, coming from a different culture on the other side of the world. And there was one experience that I had that I will never forget. I was just walking across the street, and we're along the street, and there's an older gentleman coming towards me. We were just passing each other. He was wearing a hat, and he was saying hello to me. And I was so surprised, so I just almost jumped, and I said hello to him. I was so happy. Here, this hello, we don't do that in my native country unless we know each other well. And it was so fun, and then it just made my day. They don't ever forget it. I'm trying to do the same thing.
Let me comment on that. This is the most frequent comment I hear from my Scandinavian students. They say, people talk to you here. People that you don't even know, they come up and they say hello, they talk to you on the bus. And they don't know what to make of it. It's just, it's so different. You do not talk to strangers, apparently, in Sweden or Norway. Not habitually, either. So the first one is, yeah, what country was it?
Sweden.
Sweden, yeah. So my Swedish students say that all the time. But after a while, they get into it, you know, they start California. California, and they, start talking to people, and they kind of like it, but very different than the cultural norm. Okay, Michael.
I just wanted to add that you can have the same experience in this country. I've had a number of times if you go down south, like even just in West Virginia and places down there in small towns, strangers, as a stranger, they wave at you, they smile, and they just like they're old friends. It's really a little unnerving for me.
Okay, so we're going to move on. All right. For next week, dispute negative beliefs. Okay. Now let's move. I'm going to talk about some stuff in the chapter that we read for this week. If you didn't read the book, it's okay. It will become clear what I'm talking about. Let me say by preamble that
I really like this book, and I really like Marty, and I really think positive psychology is more with good stuff, as you'll see. We're just getting going. It gets more and more profound. But this chapter, chapter 5, I think it is, the one about the past, dealing with the past, there are a couple of issues that I have here that I need to kind of talk about at a little bit of late. Okay? And probably several of you had a little bit of issue with a couple of things that were said there. So, first of all, his basic point about the chapter. An apology? I wish he hadn't put that thing in about Everett Gordon and his mama. I mean, that was not, it didn't belong in a positive psychology textbook. I'm sorry. If you didn't read it, don't. I'm not going to talk about it. Everett Gordon and his mother. Okay. What I do want to emphasize is that he said there were three things in the chapter to pay attention to make your feeling about the past more positive. One is forgiveness, okay? One is gratefulness, and the third I'm going to talk about in a minute, okay? But those things are very valid. If you can increase your forgiveness and your gratefulness, you're certainly going to feel better about your past. Okay, here are the things I want to talk about from the chapter. First, at the beginning of the chapter, he talked about the link between thought and feeling. And he said, the Freudians said emotion always drives thought. He said, the cognitive psychologists like Tim Beck say that thought always drives emotion. So who's right? And he kind of attempted a reconciliation, but it was a weak reconciliation. I'm going to talk to you about why they're both wrong, but both of those points of view are not true, or not entirely true. Len?
Isn't it possible they're both true?
They are at different times. We're going to talk about this in a minute, okay? So, the problem is, they still are part of the mind-body problem, and they think that thoughts and feelings are separate things. Does thinking drive feeling? Does feeling drive thinking? And sometimes one drives the other, sometimes the other drives one. But it's not that one is driving the other. As I told you a couple weeks ago, the way I look at thought-feeling is your organism is constantly adjusting to the situation it's in, and that involves thinking differently and feeling differently. Your body is setting itself for approach or avoid. Your thoughts are going along with that process of yes or no. So you're constantly, at every moment, without your awareness, opening or closing, preparing for what you expect to happen next. That's what keeps us alive. If you tune in to the part of the process that's going on in your head, you say, I'm thinking about this. You tune in to the part of the process that's going on in your body, you say, I'm feeling about this. But they're both happening at the same time. So it's not that thought drives feeling or feeling drives thought. They're part of the same process. And if you pay attention to one part, then you say, oh, this is setting that off. You say, pay attention to this, and it's setting that off. There's more profundity here, though. Okay. First, you can create in your mind an imaginary situation, which then causes your mind and body to react to that situation as if it was real. If I imagine that I just won the lottery, then my thoughts are, oh, I'm going to go out and buy that car I want, I'm going to buy that house I want, and my feelings leak, right? So I created an imaginary situation that then my mind-body system adjusted to. So you can deliberately, so you're constantly reacting not just to the situation that you're in, but to situations that your mind creates. Now, why does your mind create those situations? If you look into your unconscious, you find out, and many of us know this, that whatever's going on consciously, there's something deeper going on unconsciously. And that what's going on unconsciously frequently injects itself into consciousness, and suddenly you have a thought, what if I won the lottery? But really what's going on unconsciously is how the hell am I going to pay my bills? You know, and that's a thought and a feeling. So the point is that there's profundity here. It's not just conscious thought and conscious feeling. There are at least two levels of thought and feeling. Conscious and unconscious, and the unconscious frequently drives the conscious thought and feeling. So that's a little bit more profound and nuanced way to look at this argument, which is a false argument. Okay. Does that make sense? Sometimes I have to be a professor, okay? This was
the professor talking. So is there, I don't want to leave that unless there's any question about it. What I'm saying is, you can't separate thought and feeling. They're part of the same process. Ani.
So, the imagining, where does that fit in with consciousness and unconsciousness?
Imagination comes from unconscious into conscious, and it creates a conscious experience. Now, what are the levels of the unconscious? Maybe there's a collective unconscious speaking through you when you imagine something. Maybe it's a personal unconscious. But imagination doesn't come from the air. It comes from a deeper level of your being. It's received by the frontal lobe. Where it comes from is an open question. It may be that our brain isn't making our consciousness. It's transducing it. We're receiving it from some other source. That's the great transpersonal question, is are we inventing consciousness each individually, or are each of us receiving a larger consciousness? So where imagination comes from is an open question, but the last stage is when it becomes, I'm imagining something. It's something that's driving that conscious experience, a more profound process. Okay, tell me your first name.
If I have a kinesthetic feeling, it seems to me that then my thoughts become activated, and something's going on, and then I interpret that. So, to me, thought is quite a driver of what emotions follow from my kinesthetic feeling, because of my interpretation.
But your kinesthetic feeling can be looked at as an emotion, a first emotional cause, which causes the thought, which causes the secondary emotional cause. What is this kinesthetic feeling of my body adjusting itself? I mean, depending on how you look at it, that might be kind of a deeper emotional process. In any event, what you're treating it to, Susan, is this is a complex process. Yes. Okay, so that's what I'm saying is that the book was a surface argument about a much more complex thing. So I leave it to you to figure out the link between thought and feeling and the levels of thought and feeling that exist, consciously and unconsciously. It's a larger question than the address, and that psychology has addressed.
Second.
What do you do about feeling? What he said is, if you get people to indulge their anger, they don't get less angry, they don't get far to get over it, they get more angry. You tell them to beat the pillow and scream, they get angrier and angrier and angrier. So you shouldn't do that. You should tell them to cool it, to suppress their feeling. What? Are you for real? The two extremes here are overindulgence in emotion, overexpression of it, and suppression of it. Neither of those extremes is healthy. Now, there are people for whom you want them to scream or in therapy or beat the pillow because they're emotionally blocked. They learn not to feel certain feelings. So you have to help them yell, sing loud, beat the pillow, do something to get anger laid by. You play sad music. Even in the case of one of my teachers, put onion underneath the nose to get the crying thing that they blocked when they were 2 years old to start to happen again. You play really funny videos and you sit with them and you laugh in your belly to help people who are not able to feel joy open that up. So in therapy, you might want to help people over-accentuate feelings when they're blocked. But in life, if you constantly walk around pissed off, you're going to get heart disease. It's just a precursor. You can't be constantly pumping adrenaline and cortisol into your system. You can't be raising blood pressure all the time. So overindulgence in emotion is right. It's not the answer. But suppression of emotion leads to so many ills. If you won't feel your feelings, I'm not angry, I'm not sad, I'm not, if you deny these kinds of things, there's all kinds of personality patterns. There's a type B personality, the stress personality, who is distressed but won't admit it because it looks bad or they don't want to feel bad about themselves.
That's a pretty hard disease kind of personality. It's probably a type C personality, a cancer-prone personality, which is a personality that depresses him or herself in order not to feel certain feelings. And so, you know, the point about this is emotional suppression is not healthy. So what do you do with your feelings? The middle way is the way. You feel the feelings as fully as you can, but you don't overindulge them and act them out. You just let them run through you as waves. And you acknowledge what your system is doing. You let it do what it's doing. But you act from a skillful, helpful kind of point of view. Every feeling is energy in motion. Every feeling has it wants you to do something. That's why you have the feeling. So if you're if you have the feeling of being sad, it wants you to let go and release, and you cry, and then you feel better. If you won't let yourself cry, then you won't cry, then the feeling hangs around. So the point about it is, you need to feel your feelings as fully as they occur, but you then don't hang on to them and overindulge them, and you don't try to suppress them. You just let them move through you, and when there's a direction that they point to, you move in that direction. For example, anger. People who won't feel anger, if you won't feel anger, anger is about creating a change so that you're not threatened. If you won't feel anger, then you don't do anything to create the change. You're going to feel angrier and angrier and angrier, but you're not telling the world that something needs to change. But if you yell at somebody, you create more difficulty. So you feel angry, and then you wait till you calm down, and you go to that person and say, look, we have to talk. Something really upset me. Can we do this differently so that I don't get upset and so that we're more on the same page? So anger was a message to change the world for the better. People who can't feel anger have no courage, no determination, no will. So the point about emotion is don't overexpress it, don't hold on to it, don't overindulge it, it will hurt you. Cry enough, but don't cry yourself for the rest of your life, you know? And don't suppress it because it will definitely hurt you. But feel it fully and act wisely.
Second point, okay? Third point, and I will quote directly on this one, because this is the one that is the fall out of the chair one. You understand what I'm doing here? You know, I'm using this as an excuse to do all the important psychological stuff in one sort of poof. Okay? So it's not just about reading this book, it's about what it sets off in us, the discussions that we have, the considerations that we have. Because he's treating all the important stuff here, he's just treating it in his particular way. Okay, so to quote on page 67, three quarters of the way down, you don't need to look, I mean, just one sentence. To quote Dr. Seligman, the major traumas of childhood may have some influence on adult personality, but only a barely detectable one. So, hey Marty, let's just take childhood and throw it right out the window. Clinical psychology, why do we need that? You know, therapy, forget that. You just got to change your mind after school, you know? I tried to be nice about this. For the last week, I've been trying to say this in a way that was calm and clear and not, oh my God. But I guess I'm obviously failing. Okay, so here's the deal. Okay? So when he says only a barely detectable one, I think, who is doing this detection and what exercises are they using? Is this a bunch of people in academic institutions in ivory towers saying, oh no, childhood doesn't really matter? You know, who are they talking to? Martin himself said he became a psychologist because when he was a kid, the way to get, in chapter 2 he says, the way to get girls' attention was to listen to them. He kind of listened to them and then he would pay attention to him. What does he become? A psychologist? Did childhood have no effect on his life? Come on. So the point about this is that for effect, because he wanted to make a point, he said, look, you can't be imprisoned by your childhood. If you feel like your childhood is absolutely determinative of who you are, you have no possibility of change. So he makes the point, he
can't look at it that way, then you can't grow. But to go to the other extreme and say, oh, it's childhood is very little or any effect, even major trauma has very little of any effect, that's a disservice to people, because you may have to do quite a bit of work on yourself to realize what your emotional patterning is and how that is limiting your life, and painfully you might have to try to understand the world in a different way and react differently. So that's the stuff of therapy, is the stuff of helping people realize how they're built, where it came from, and how we can rebuild some of those non-functional patterns. So if you had a little difficulty with those words, so did everybody else, you know.
Was he
just made a blanket statement.
No, I read it.
Yeah. Yeah, there's tons of evidence, some of which accrued by cognitive psychologists and basically come from academia, is, look, people who had divorced when they were little, they don't really do any worse. You know, they get married themselves. I just don't think that I would really like to know what the divorce rate is for people who have seen early divorce in their lives. I would predict that people who have seen early divorce when they were growing up are more likely to get divorced later on. I don't know. But I know there's tons and tons of evidence here. I can't put it all together. I can just say that it's not the way Marty said. For example, right, the whole everything. Attachment theory. Secure attachment leads to this, and this. Marty's actually going to talk about how secure attachment leads to all these positive outcomes, and insecure attachment leads to all these negative outcomes. It's right in his book. Okay, attachment happens incredibly early in your life, maybe even in the womb it starts to happen. So if it doesn't have any effect, how can he talk about the fact that attachment is, everything in psychology you throw out the window if that were true. Okay, so anyway. Okay, one last thing that I want to read you something. One last thing. The gratitude survey that was in that chapter, I don't know if you had the same reaction that I did, but I feel like I'm a pretty grateful person. And I took that survey, I'm in a lower quarter on gratitude. It made me feel uncomfortable. So what I thought, what? I'm grateful, and I'm like, what? So then I looked a little more closely. I looked at the sample that I was being compared to. Does anybody remember what that sample that I was being compared to was? Anybody notice that? Who got upset about the fact that they were in the lower quarter or a half for gratefulness, even though they're grateful? Okay, on what page is it on? Well, now I can tell you. The sample that we are being compared to is 12,227, I think, people who took an online survey, readers of Spirituality and Health magazine. These are not the typical person walking around. Compared to people who in 2001 took an online survey from Spirituality and Health magazine, I think I'm probably in the lower quarter of gratefulness and thankfulness. I do not think everybody walks around with wings, okay? But what I'm saying, this is not a representative sample of the population. You really have to pay attention to who you're being compared to when you take any test or survey. How the test is normed is hugely important. If students in California are being compared to students in Alabama, we're probably going to do real well on standardized tests. I don't know, but the point is you have to compare the people that you're testing to equivalent people, not to a very different group of people. And in the case of that gratitude survey, I was being compared to people that go to the Rainbow Bridge at Ojai every day. You know what I mean? I like the Rainbow Bridge, by the way. But those of you who know what the Rainbow Bridge is, it's a health food store that it has an ethereal atmosphere to it. I think. It's a good place, actually. Okay.
So I had a decision to make. I knew that it was going to be really hot today, and so I shouldn't even mention, but I have a video that I wanted to play, but I'm not going to play it. I'm playing it in the future. I'll get everything in, but I won't do it today because I want to close the place up. I have an alternative thing that I've been meaning to talk to you about, and I want to do that now. Okay? But I'm not forgetting the video for today and another one. There's time to build those in. Next week it probably won't be quite this hot. So here's the thing that I wanted to talk to you about. Remember I told you that I'm going to build in some consciousness class stuff into this class. It's not going to be purely positive psychology, but there's stuff happening that I want you to know about. Well, here's something that I want you to know about that isn't entirely positive, so you might want to use your disputation skills on this as you think about it. Okay. All right, here we go. So some of you may have more information than me about this, so chime in a few minutes, okay, if you do. The May-June issue of MIT Technology Review, and MIT puts out a magazine every bi-monthly that has to do with the latest stuff happening in science and technology. It's a wonderful magazine. And the issue that came for May-June this year has a little kid, beautiful little kid on the cover, and the headline is, "We can now engineer the human race." Let me read you two little sections from the report on this possibility. Okay. This is from, written by Jennifer Doudna, who's a professor of biology and chemistry at the University of California, Berkeley. She's one of the inventors of the CRISPR technology, which is the technology that makes all this possible, the gene editing technology. So she's in the very forefront, you may know the prize of CRISPR, gene editing. Here's what she has to say. And of course, she's going to be very pro this approach, but not entirely so. My dad loved to hike the rainforests near our home in the Big Island of Hawaii, oftentimes for mushrooms, with Don Hemis, his colleague at the University of Hawaii. The goal of these trips was not to harvest mushrooms, but to photograph them for a research project that Hemis was leading. When I accompanied them, by the way, this is a young woman, I was always struck by the incredible diversity of the mushrooms that we found. Having learned a little about genetics in school, I wondered what kinds of DNA changes were responsible for these organisms' range of colors, shapes, and sizes. And how can we figure out these molecular signatures? Fast forward 30-odd years, and it's become routine to sequence the entire genomes of organisms. That is, we can take DNA from any organism, and we can tell you exactly what the structure of that DNA is. And to interpret that information to reveal the underlying causes of observable traits. We can try to find out why people get depressed, why they get anxious, why their hair is whatever color it is, et cetera, et cetera. We just look at the genes and we see how that correlates with the phenotype, the thing that we can see, the phenotype. A simple and effective technology for making precise changes to those genomic sequences has exploded into widespread use. Okay? So we can now not only map the DNA, we can change any particular area of it that we want. And of course, that's going to change certain properties of the organism. The technology called CRISPR relies on a programmable DNA cutting enzyme called Cas9, C-A-S-9, together with its guide RNA, to let scientists alter the genetic information within cells,
tissues and the whole organisms. They don't only have to do this in a sperm and egg, they can do this in a whole organism or a tissue. I don't know how, but they do. Scientists have used this to generate new strains of wheat, to cure genetic disease in the livers of adult mice, and to produce and alter fungal cells capable of efficient biofuel synthesis. So, funguses that make biofuels. The CRISPR-Cas9 technology has opened up a world of research opportunities that were inconceivable just 3 years ago. The technology will benefit humankind in many ways. There's also a growing appreciation of the risks involved. CRISPR-Cas9 technology can, as an example, be used to alter the DNA in germ cells or embryos. Germ cells are sperm and egg. Or embryos, resulting in permanent changes to the genetic makeup of every differentiated cell in the resulting organism, and to that organism's progeny, as we can change the DNA in an embryo, and that can end the change that grows up into an adult and is passed on to other people, to the kids. Such applications could be employed to cure genetic disease in humans. If we can find out what causes sickle cell anemia, one gene, and we can catch that in the embryo, we can engineer that embryo and get rid of sickle cell anemia. That's happened. Unfortunately, most of the things that we suffer don't have just one gene involved. They have hundreds of thousands, so it's not so easy. Such applications could be deployed to cure genetic disease in humans or to limit the fitness of disease-carrying organisms. We can change the way that malaria-carrying mosquitoes work. They won't carry malaria. But the intricacies of genetic interaction mean those uses could also have unintended consequences, perhaps triggering other diseases. We're fooling around, we're playing God here, we're fooling around with stuff, and maybe when we play tinker with this, it causes some unintended consequence. Research is needed to understand the utility and risks of CRISPR-Cas9 in cells, including human germ cells, as well as the risks inherent in human clinical applications that might be possible. We should research the ramifications of using genome engineering to control organisms such as mosquitoes that can spread malaria, or how do you pronounce dengue fever?
Dengue
fever. Well, thanks. While we should embrace this technology, scientists must also come together to guide peers and regulators as to its responsible use. So now, she started a letter which many prominent geneticists have signed, saying, before we proceed with engineering the human germline, we better talk about the risks involved. However,
27:28.
Old copy of the
Fast Magazine. What?
This is an old copy.
No, I don't. Okay. Now the rubber meets the road, so to speak. The title of this article, that was just a preamble, kind of a short statement. I'm just going to read you a little bit of this article. It's called Engineering the Perfect Baby. You get what's going on. If anyone had devised a way to create a genetically engineered baby, I figured George Church would know about it. His name is Church, it's pretty nice. At his labyrinthine laboratory on the Harvard Medical School campus, you can find researchers giving E. coli bacterium a novel genetic code never seen in nature. That is, they're changing the DNA to make an organism that never existed before. Around another bend, others are carrying out a plan to use DNA engineering to resurrect the woolly mammoth. Yeah. His lab, Church likes to say, is the center of a new technological genesis, one in which man rebuilds creation to suit himself. Should have been that man or males or females rebuild creation to suit her or himself. Okay, when I visited the lab last June, Church proposed that I speak to a young Harvard postdoctoral student named Luhan Yang, a Harvard recruit from Beijing. She'd been a key player in developing a powerful new technology for editing DNA called CRISPR-Cas9. With Church, Yang has founded a small biotechnology company to engineer the genomes of pigs and cattle, sliding in beneficial genes and editing away bad ones. As I listened to Yang, I waited for a chance to ask my real questions. Can any of this be done to human beings? Can we improve the human gene pool? The position of much of mainstream science has been that such meddling would be unsafe, irresponsible, and even impossible. But Yang didn't hesitate. Yes, of course, she said. In fact, the Harvard Laboratory had a project underway to determine how it could be achieved, how we could change the human genome. She flipped open her laptop to a PowerPoint slide entitled Germline Editing Medium. That is how you edit the human egg and sperm. Here it was, a technological proposal to alter human heredity. Germline is biologists' jargon for the egg and the sperm, which combine to form an embryo. By editing the DNA of these cells or the embryo itself, it could be possible to correct disease genes and pass those genetic fixes on to future generations. Such a technology could be used to rid families of scourges like cystic fibrosis. It might also be possible to install genes that offer lifelong protection against infection. Oh, it will offer lifelong protection against infection, Alzheimer's, and Yang told me, maybe even the effects of aging. So we may be able to alter human embryos now so that Alzheimer's doesn't happen, various diseases don't happen, and even that we don't get much older, or we don't get older as much. Okay. Such history-making medical advances could be as important to this century as vaccines were to the last. I think more important. That's the promise. The fear is that germline engineering is a path toward a dystopia of super people and designer babies to those who can afford it. Want a child with blue eyes and blonde hair? Why not design a highly intelligent group of people who could be tomorrow's leaders and scientists? Just 3 years after its initial development, CRISPR technology is already widely used by biologists as a kind of search and replace tool to alter DNA, even down to the level of a single genetic letter. It's so precise that it's expected to turn into a promising new approach for gene therapy in people with devastating illnesses. The idea that physicians could directly correct a faulty gene in, say, the blood cells of a patient with sickle cell anemia. Okay, the idea is that we could do that.
I don't know. Let me do this first.
But that kind of gene therapy wouldn't affect germ cells, and the changes in the DNA wouldn't get passed on to future generations. So we could deal with adults right now and change their DNA in various tissues, and that might cure them of diseases that we currently can't cure them of. But this is about what do we do with the germ egg that makes the embryo, that makes the person, that's going to pass those genes along. In contrast, the genetic changes created by germline engineering would be passed on, and that's what's made the idea seem so objectionable. So far, caution and ethical concerns have had the upper hand. A dozen countries, not including the United States, have banned germline engineering, and scientific societies have unanimously concluded that it would be too risky to do so at present. The European Union's Convention on Human Rights and Biomedicine says tampering with the gene pool would be a crime against, quote, human dignity and human rights. But all of these declarations were made before it was actually feasible to precisely engineer the germline. Now with CRISPR, it's eminently possible. So is it being done?
Um,
Because of time, I will just tell you that it is being done in China, and it is expected that results of that work on engineering the human embryo will actually be published imminently. So the point about this is, whether they say no, no, no or not, this technology exists. It's going to be used by wealthy people. It's going to be used by people who don't feel bound by scientific pronouncements that you shouldn't do this. This is here. So, do you have any, Carl, do you have any comment on this? Any comment on particular on this?
Well, it's one of many topics that we covered in my AG biology class. And it's some of the material on it has been obtuse, but it's getting to be better, as the article you pointed out. So it's possible to actually teach it with talks and lectures that are understandable. And yes, there are the first experiments that have been done in China, and I'm sure that there's something going on in Korea and other countries too, because it's highly feasible. So we're going to see changes. Mostly getting rid of diseases that plague families, genetic diseases. But yeah, you can do anything you want. You can improve your dog or your cat, or it's like cloning. It was a powerful tool. Once it becomes routine, you can't really prevent it from being abused, depending on how you define abuse.
If people are willing to pay $20 million to go out in space, I know how to do this technology. It's pretty easy. I learned it in college, you know. Just pay me $100 million, then $1 billion, what the hell. And I'll make your kid 7 feet tall and have an IQ of 200, and
I just heard on National Public Radio that you can get your dog or cat cloned. It's being done now for $100,000. You send a small sample of DNA, I think it's like saliva, to someplace in China, and you can get 2-3 clones.
So the point about all this, it's just something you need to think about. It holds great promise for helping with disease. It really is a huge breakthrough in terms of making the human race and not only human race, but the whole biological enterprise healthier, work better. So it's an amazing step forward in that regard. But it also has potential for remarkable abuse. And so this is something that everybody's going to have to kind of be aware of, and that there has to be very much public discussion about. It shouldn't be decided quietly. Carl, you've got the last word.
We should think about these biological technology advances sort of like the way we think about toothpaste on nuclear weapons.
So the power is there. The question is how we're going to use this kind of power. But the implications of what we can now do, you understand this is, we can now take creation into our own hands. The question from my psychologist's point of view is, given the power that we have over the physical and biological world, are we mature enough psychologically to use that power well? What I'll do with this article is, if I can make some copies, I'll get them for you for next week. That's the best thing. Robert will come to the rescue again. If you go to swap.org/censor, I'll give Robert the magazine.
You can I subscribe.
Oh, you get it.
Tell me which articles you want.
Say again?
I subscribe. Just tell me which articles you want.
Okay. So, yeah, be on swap.org. Yay, Robert. Okay. Thank you. Okay, if you don't forget that if you want a copy of Confidence, just sign up on the table and Ruth will email you a copy. And if you would like to buy her CD, see her. She's going to be probably over by that table. So I will see you next week. Don't forget to dress really warmly. It's going to snow like hell.